My guest is poet Kenneth Koch. Koch is a scholar and a fan of the great tradition of classical poetry and modern European poetry. In some of his poems, he plays with the classic form and infuses it with humor. In the New York Times Book Review, Koch was called perhaps the most polished wit writing in English, a poet writing in the discontinuous, unexpected rhythms of the Marx Brothers. In the 1950s, Kenneth Koch's circle of friends included fellow poets John Ashbery and Frank O'Hara, and painters Larry Rivers and Jane Freilicher. They collaborated on artistic projects and became known for their defiantly anti-academic stance. Some critics dubbed them the New York School of Poets. Kenneth Koch is known beyond the literary world for his earlier work teaching poetry to children and senior citizens. Since 1959, he's taught at Columbia University, where he's a professor of English and comparative literature. Penguin Books has just published his book Seasons on Earth. It includes two earlier poems, Co and The Duplications, along with a new introduction, which he'll read from a little bit later. I spoke to Kenneth Koch earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked him to read an excerpt of his poem The Art of Poetry from his book The Art of Love, which is a humorous homage to Ovid's The Art of Love. He told me why he wrote the poem.
Well, I don't suppose poets usually really know completely why they've written a particular poem. I know what happened before I wrote the poem. One thing that happened was I'd worked for almost 3 years on a considerably longer poem called The Art of Love, and there'd been a lot of problems in writing that poem, and when I finally solved them, when I was finally satisfied with this poem, which is about 30 pages long, I wrote three other poems that I liked a great deal in a rather short time. The Art of Poetry, Some General Instructions, and The Problem of Anxiety, and shortly after that I wrote a poem called On Beauty, too. That is, once I'd mastered this kind of, or for myself as well as I could, this tone of being writing a poem and yet seeming to give instructions at the same time, it was easy for me to write other poems. Now, I know a lot more about writing poetry than I do about love. That is, writing poetry seems, although impossible, a little more manageable than love to me. Or at least I know more about it. And one thing that probably went into my writing The Art of Poetry was that I'm used to thinking about it since I've been writing poetry for so long, and I've taught it a lot. Maybe particularly before I wrote any of these instructional poems, I had been doing a certain amount of teaching of children to write poetry. And it wasn't so much the teaching of children that inspired the sort of instructional style of these poems, I think, as it was the essays that I wrote about the teaching, in which I was trying to show people how to do things, and also the talks I gave about it.
You know, I should ask you to read it because it's not only very interesting, but it's also very funny. So,
all right,
why don't we give it a shot?
This is the end of The Art of Poetry, which is last two pages of about a 15-page poem, in which I consider a lot of the things that bother poets and a lot of problems that come up. As to whether or not you use rhyme and how modern you are, it is something your genius can decide on every morning when you get out of bed. What a clear day. Good luck at it. Though meter is probably, and rhyme too, probably dead for a while, except in narrative stanzas. You try it out. The pleasure of the easy inflection between meter and these easy vocable lines is a pleasure. If you are able to have it, you are unlikely to renounce. As for surrealistic methods and techniques, they have become a natural part of writing. Your poetry, if possible, should be extended somewhat beyond your experience, while still remaining true to it. Unconscious material should play a luscious part in what you write, since without the unconscious part, you know very little. And your plainest statement should be even better than plain. A reader should put your work down puzzled, distressed, and illuminated, ready to believe it is curious to be alive. As for your sense of what good you do by writing, compared to what good statesmen, doctors, flower salesmen, and missionaries do, perhaps you do less and perhaps more. If you would like to try one of these other occupations for a while, try it. I imagine you will find that poetry does something they do not do, whether it is more important or not, and if you like poetry, you will like doing that yourself. Poetry need not be an exclusive occupation. Some think it should, some think it should not. But you should have years for poetry, or at least, if not years, months, at certain points in your life. Weeks, days, and hours may not suffice. Almost any amount of time suffices to be a minor poet, once you have mastered a certain amount of the craft for writing a poem. But I do not see the good of minor poetry. Like going to the Tour d'Argent to get dinner for your dog, or almost being friends with someone, or hanging around but not attending a school, or being a nurse's aide for the rest of your life after getting a degree in medicine, what is the point of it? And some may wish to write songs and use their talent that way. Others may even end up writing ads. To those of you who are left, when these others have departed, and you are a strange bunch, I alone address these words. It is true that good poetry is difficult to write. Poetry is an escape from anxiety, and a source of it as well. On the whole, it seems to me worthwhile. At the end of a poem, one may be tempted to grow too universal, philosophical, and vague, or to bring in history or the sea, but one should not do that if one can possibly help it, since it makes each thing one writes sound like everything else. And poetry and life are not like that. Now I have said enough.
I like that poem a lot. And,
thank you.
I think, you know, in many ways, you're really never solemn about poetry. You're serious about it, but never solemn about it.
I hope that's true.
You've written about wanting to be as good or better than the best old poetry and to avoid all the mistakes of bad modern poets. Why don't we start with the good old poetry? What do you love most
about
poetry?
If you're going to ask me who I think the bad modern poets are, you're going to be disappointed.
No, naming names wasn't going to be a part of this. But what are some of the great poems of the past that made you fall in love with poetry?
Oh, I don't know. It probably started with Mother Goose, since I started writing poems when I was about 5 years old. But when I really began to get serious about poetry, well, there were several times. Once was when I was 15, when my uncle gave me a book of Shelley and showed me some of my uncle's own poems. And then another stage was when at 17 I discovered modern poetry, which was really quite late for somebody to discover it. But I had a Louis Untermeyer anthology of modern poetry, and I liked most of the things in it. The poets who've inspired me since are so many. I mean, I rather like to feel the influence of other poets, but obviously from my work, I like Byron a lot. That is the Byron of Don Juan. Among modern poets, I've gotten a lot from William Carlos Williams and Wallace Stevens and Ezra Pound, and there are a lot of French poets who've influenced me a lot, such as Apollinaire and Rimbaud and Reverdy and many others.
Well, I want to get back to what you said about wanting to avoid all the mistakes of bad modern poets. I don't want you to name names, but what are some of the dead ends that you think modern poetry run into?
Well, you know, there are things that might be dead ends for me and not for other people. All I know is what's a dead end for me. A dead end for me is trying to be, writing symbolically, having a hidden meaning in what I write, imposing seriousness on something which, that is what the distinction that you made about solemnity is one I like. I mean, I think my poetry is serious. There's a kind of mournfulness and longing in a lot of modern poetry that does not, I don't find convincing. It's true that I grew up in a period when T.S. Eliot was the most highly considered poet by most people I knew. And if you didn't write poetry that was not only a little solemn, but even a little depressed, it didn't seem like serious poetry. I think I found a way out of this partly in French poetry. I don't. It's very hard for me to tell you the qualities I don't like. If I had a poem in front of me, I could tell you what it is, but it's a kind of clumsy use of symbolism, a meaningless sadness and longing. Not that sadness and longing are not a part of poetry, and not that they're not a part of my poetry, but ask me something else.
Did you ever go through a period when you were younger, when you were writing bad, brooding, depressed poems, like so many of us did?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that all sad poetry is bad at all. My recent poetry is quite sad.
That's true. But I think, like, during high school when people are young, they tend to confuse. Well, they tend to just be especially brooding in their poems.
I don't blame them.
It's a tough period, huh?
Yeah.
You studied in college with Delmore Schwartz.
Yeah.
Was he your first example of what leading a poet's life was?
I didn't know too much about Delmore's life. I certainly found it very inspiring to be studying with him. I liked his work and I liked him a lot. Yeah, he was the first poet that I knew, as I remember, and I didn't really get to know him terribly well.
You, so shortly after college, I think, became good friends with poet John Ashbery and Frank O'Hara, with jazz musician and painter Larry Rivers. And it just strikes me as such an interesting coming together of literature and painting and music. Did you see a lot of connections between those different forms? Did you feel this shared sensibility?
Well, a good deal has been written about that period in the early and late 50s. It was terrific to be friends with such good poets as John and Frank, and such good painters as Larry Rivers and Jane Freilacher. And we also knew Bill de Kooning and lots of other people. And it was a very inspiring atmosphere. I don't think I thought much about the connections between the arts. I know I spent a certain amount of time in painters' studios where there was a very free, energetic atmosphere about creating things, which I liked. And I liked the fact there was something very attractive about the painters' lives, and that they sometimes could actually sell their work, and that they could actually see people looking at their work. The poet's life is rather lonely as far as the composition of poems goes. But I think I've lost the question.
Well, what did you think about when people referred to that group as the New York School? Did that mean much to you?
Well, of course, I was glad they were referring to us at all. There was not really such a thing as a New York School of Poetry in the European sense, like in France or Italy or Spain, where there was a manifesto and an announced program. But certainly there was a great deal of friendship and also a good deal of similarity in the work among Frank and John and me at the beginning. Later on, I thought our poetry diverged quite a lot. So I don't mind if people talk about the New York School as a geographical way of talking about something. Also, there are similarities in the early work, I think.
There's a poem about your relationship with those people. The poem is called Fate, and I'd like to ask you to read the beginning of it. And it's featured in your collection of poems called Selected Poems.
Oh, okay. This is a poem about, since I'm only going to read a little of it, I went to Europe for the first time when I was in my early 20s, and my best friends, Frank and John and Jane and Larry, they hadn't been to Europe yet. Or maybe Larry was there. No, he wasn't. My best friends had not been to Europe yet, and I was all excited about my time in France, and I came back with some whiskey I'd gotten in Shannon, Ireland, where the planes used to stop, and tried to tell them how wonderful Europe was, and they wouldn't pay any attention to me because they hadn't been there and they were interested in other things. Later on, it always seemed to me this was sort of a wonderful moment in my life, though I didn't know why. I called it fate. In a room on West 10th Street in June of 1951, Frank O'Hara and I and Larry Rivers. I actually do not remember if Larry was there, but he would be there later some winter night on the stairway, sitting waiting, a demented telephone, as Frank said in an article about him. But then on the stairs, unhappy in a youthful manner, much happened later. Frank, John Ashbery, Jane Freilacher, and I had just come back from Europe for the first time. I had a bottle of Irish whiskey I'd bought in Shannon where the plane stopped, and we drank it. And I told my friends about Europe. They'd never been there, how much I'd loved it. I was so happy to be there with them. And my Europe, too, which I had, Greece, Italy, France, Scandinavia, and England. Imagine having all that the first time. The walls were white in that little apartment, so tiny. The rooms are so small, but we all fitted into one and talked. Frank, so sure of his talent, but didn't say it that way. I didn't know it till after he was dead, just how sure he had been. And John, unhappy and brilliant and silly, and of them all my first friend. We had met at Harvard. They tended, except Frank, to poo-poo what I said about Europe. And even Frank was more interested, but ever polite, when sober. I couldn't tell it, but barely tended. They tended to be much more interested in gossip, such as who had been sleeping with whom and what I was and what was selling and going on, whereat I was a little hurt, but used to it. My expectations from my friendships were absurd, but that way I got so much out of them. In fact, it wasn't causal, but the two ways at once. I was never so happy with anyone as I was with those friends, at that particular time, on that day, with that bottle of Irish whiskey, the time 4 in the afternoon, or 3 in the afternoon, or 2 or 5, I don't know what. And why do I think that my being so happy is so urgent and important? It seems some kind of evidence of the truth, as if I could go back and take it, or do I just want to hold what there is of it now? I'll stop there. That's about the first half of it.
Thanks for reading that. I like that part where you talk about how everybody was really more interested in talking about gossip than poetry. Was that true?
Well, I didn't want to talk about poetry. I wanted to talk about how I'd felt in Europe. And since they hadn't been there, they weren't interested in talking about that. But yes, people are much more interested. We certainly were then in talking about other people than in talking about poetry.
I want to talk with you more about your poems and have you read some more, but first we have to take a short break. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is poet Kenneth Koch, who's joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. And his latest book is a reissue of his poem Seasons on Earth. And there's a new poem as an introduction to this poem that he wrote several years ago. You know, for years you've managed to teach yet not be a, quote, academic, in the sense that we would use the word when we talk about academic poets.
Is that a question?
Yes.
Oh, how did I not become an academic poet?
Well, yeah, I mean, whatever the word academic means, we use it as a genre for...
How do you dance without becoming muscle-bound? I don't know. I really can't answer that question about myself. I'd have to know what you mean by an academic poet. I mean, when some people say it, it's good. When some people say it, it's bad. When some people say it, it's very bad. Usually what an academic poet means is someone who's a little tilted maybe toward criticism and scholarship instead of toward poetry. That is, that he relies more on what's been written by other people than on his own feelings, or takes what's already been written more seriously, or goes along with certain attitudes, or is afraid to experiment. I mean, I don't really know. It's hard to deal with the question.
You became a semi-celebrity for a while through your books about teaching children and about teaching senior citizens how to write poetry. And a friend of mine said he even saw you on the Merv Griffin show. Now, I can't think of a lot of poets who are on that show. What was it like for you to kind of get invited into this world where poets are seldom invited, to be written up in Time magazine and be invited onto TV variety shows?
One, I like the word semi-celebrity. That's funny. Also, two, I was not on the Merv Griffin show.
He must have seen you on another one.
I was on
an unreliable source.
I was on the David Frost show. He used to have a weekly show with 5 of my student poets. I liked that work. I've written extensively about it and would rather talk about poetry, but I mean, I liked the work and I liked the attention my work got, because what I really wanted to do when I did that work was to get people to teach poetry to kids in a way that would make them like it and not dislike it. So and of course it's a lot of fun to be on TV and to get lots of mail for a while, but then you have to answer it.
You were working with children and senior citizens, getting them to use poetry as a form of self-expression. Have you ever thought of poetry as a form of self-expression for you?
I didn't think of it as that for children and old people, nor do I think of it as that for myself, because, you know, but those words are so abstract. It's hard to know what it means. I think a poem really is, it's a work of art made out of words, and certainly what one is feeling at the time one writes is, and even before one writes, but it's mainly what one feels as one writes, is very important in what goes into the poem. But I don't think poetry is any more an expression of oneself or one's feeling than a statue is, or a symphony. And I find that concept a little hard to deal with.
You strike me as perhaps one of the few writers who actually enjoys writing, or at least has during some periods.
Oh, I think they secretly all enjoy writing. I
mean, do you really?
Or almost all of them. There are moments that are really terrible, but that are very hard when you work for a long time and the work seems to be terrible and you feel you're no good. And But most writers I know enjoy writing, otherwise they wouldn't write.
Your new book is a republication of a humorous epic poem that you wrote. What year did you write Seasons on Earth?
Well, actually, my new book is called Seasons on Earth, and it's a republication of two long poems, one called Co or A Season on Earth, and the other called The Duplications. And in front of that is about a 15-page poem called Seasons on Earth, just to confuse you, and which is sort of a meditation on how I feel about publishing these two long poems that I wrote so long ago now and how my life has changed and what really remains true and what I wrote before and what I'm publishing now and so on. I wrote Co or A Season on Earth in, what do I say in the poem? I forget. I think I was about, I'd just gotten married, so I was 29 years old. I wrote it in 1954, I guess, and 1953, 1954, and I wrote The Duplications about 15 years after that.
Would you read the introduction to these two poems that you wrote? And this you wrote very recently.
Yeah, I wrote this last year. Finished it this year, actually. This is an introduction to these two poems, but it's... I'll only read... How much did you want me to read? About 2.5 pages?
Yeah, yeah.
This is just a tiny part of it. About a tenth of it. There is a way of thinking... Oh, I should tell you that it's written in ottava rima, which rhymes A-B-A-B-A-B-C-C, and so you'll hear the rhyme sometimes and sometimes not. There is a way of thinking about happiness as being at one's side, so that one has but to bend or turn to get to it, and this for years I thought was true, or that a basket of sensual sensations brings a bliss that makes one as the winner is at Ascot. With Co, I had the first idea, the second, some first one too, went with the story of Papand. With strong opinions and with ignorance and with indifference and with aggression, with my own odd idea of what made sense and being happy some sort of an obsession, ignoring most contrary elements by going outside or changing the discussion, I used to live for it, like cows for clover, by my hot, happy sense of things bowled over. In spite of the real suffering around me, and poverty, and spite, I had the sense that there was something else. Each midday found me ecstatically in the present tense, writing. And you would have to come and pound me quite hard to drag me from my innocence. That sense, that now seems almost unbelievable, I love it, loved it. Is it irretrievable? Well, now at 60, please, some frankness, muse. I think about it less. It's an accompaniment of doing what I ought to do, and news affects it, and the vagaries of my temperament, to some degree unchanging. I find clues in books, in actions done, and statements somebody meant to be the truth, in love with its crescendos, and traveling sometimes, looking out the windows. There's no way now I can be quite believing all feeling will take shape, and I'll go walking up to that place where light blue air is weaving a cloud supply for birds to fly through, squawking, and that each exquisite sensuous day or evening is an announcement of a door unlocking, inviting me to enter. Oh, my narratives that kept me thinking of such kinds of paradise. I had the thought while I was writing Co to get into the poem every pleasure I'd ever had. The Ortopedico was down the hill, and up the hill the treasure of arms and legs that Michelangelo gave to his David, white and huge of measure. Janice and Catherine, like a Perugino, Mary and child, shared with me the Villino. I was at that time 31 or 32, even then glad I had lived so long, long enough to influence history's verdict, I still believed in that, by my big song of baseball, youth, and love. No way the Arctic of death, disease, or pain had bent the strong support floor of my being. Happiness, I thought, was what life came to, more or less.
As you've gotten older, do you feel that you've been writing about different kinds of subjects in your poems, or that your poems are more related to day-to-day reality?
Well, I have the sense that something happened in my poetry that happens to people in general. When one is young, there's this tremendous future in front of you, and it's a time for, like, you have to imagine most things because they haven't happened to you. And when you're older, there's a lot that's really happened. There's a lot of past there, and it's the influence of that gets very strong sometimes. Yeah, I think the subject of my poetry has changed at a certain point. I think at a certain point in the poems in The Art of Love, which I wrote in the early 70s, my poetry started to be increasingly about or to take into account the strongest feelings I'd had in my life and the people I'd cared most about and so on.
We only have a few seconds left, but one of the things I love about your poems is the meter, the rhythm, and the sometimes rhyme to it. It's something you've never given up in poetry that a lot of people have.
Well, very little of my work has meter or rhyme, but these two long poems and Seasons on Earth does. I mean, I'm glad if you like it. I'm glad if you like the music in my other poems, too.
Well, that's the thing, the sense of music in language.
Yeah.
That I think is really in your poems.
I think that's sort of what poetry is all about now, because at least as far as I'm concerned in writing it, unless there's some sort of music to make unexpected connections, I can only say what I know in my daily life, and that's usually not worth putting into a poem.
Kenneth Koch, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been poet Kenneth Koch, and his latest book is a collection of two long poems, Co and the Duplications. The book is called Seasons on Earth. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.